here for the first time? Welcome to both of you. So everybody else here, I think, has been here for at least one of the previous talks. Maybe not. Have you been here on Wednesday night?
Yeah,
so you haven't. Okay, so for the benefit of those who haven't been here for this Wednesday night series, this is week 5 of a Dharma seminar series that I've been doing called Difference and Unity, Encountering Injustice on the Bodhisattva Path. And we've been talking about how we human beings experience difference as threat, right? What we're not familiar with is often a little uncomfortable, a little scary, right? People who are different from us. And that's a really, really old human tendency, goes back into our pre-human evolution, right? So we don't need to judge ourselves too harshly for that, but we need to be aware of it. We need to be really aware of it because it causes so much harm in the world when we use these perceptions of difference, whether consciously or unconsciously, to justify harmful individual behaviors and collective, our political and social structures that do harm. And those differences that we perceive may be based on gender, sexuality, race, we've talked about, ability, age, appearance, and even species, right? We are very human-centric. But that's next week. And we've been exploring how Buddhist perspectives and practices can support us to see the roots of the suffering that's caused based on difference. And to use these perspectives and practices to help us respond to that suffering around us with open hearts and minds. And we've talked about how we need to maintain a sort of overarching perspective of unity and interconnectedness, but without letting that blind us to the particularities, the causes and conditions that create the barriers that separate us from others and result in great pain. And at the same time, we need not to be stuck in narrow, restrictive stories about who we are and who others are, you know, based on differences. That then those stories blind us to our connections, our humanity. So tonight, I wanted to talk about class as one more way we create barriers between us. Now here in Canada and North America in general, issues of gender, sexuality, and race are so compelling and so fraught, right? We don't really talk about class much. We tend to ignore it or downplay it. We're a land dominated by immigrants, right? And we tend to think that class is something we left behind in the old countries, right? Those old systems that many of our ancestors fled. And yet, the collective karma of those early, those European class attitudes, or Asian as well, continue to surface in our society today. And class intersects with those other factors, with race, gender, age, for example, in ways that compound injustice. And we'll look at that as we go tonight. The night I talked about gender, I said, well, gender is probably the oldest separation in our consciousness. You know, it goes back to the first simple beings that first started reproducing sexually. So that's really old, right? And then when I talked about race, I thought, oh, now that's the second oldest. You know, that goes back pre-human when we were, no. Well, yeah. No, I was thinking human beings are, you know, tribal mentalities. Well, that's, you know, the tribe across the river. But when I think about it now, class, maybe that's even older, because class goes back to, you know, animals. Chickens have a pecking order, right? The top chicken pecks on the next chicken down, and that chicken pecks on the next chicken down. It's the way animals, some animals, social animals, maintain orderly social relationships, right? By establishing these ranks of status, so they have, you know, some stability for a period of time until the top chicken gets old, and then the up-and-coming chicken replaces the top chicken. But in the more complex animals, that rank is based not just on size and strength, but on knowledge and experience as well, like an elephant's, right? Those old matriarch elephants are on top because of their experience and what they know and their memory. So throughout human history, there have been rigidly hierarchical societies, and there have been relatively egalitarian societies. And it's beyond my scope tonight to try and, you know, do a review of which ones and what kind of circumstances yield the more hierarchical or the more egalitarian societies. But one thing I think that is widely acknowledged is that societies become unstable when the gap between the rich and the poor becomes too wide, or when wealth is concentrated within a small percentage and poverty is, you know, when the pyramid is too steep, with fewer in the middle. And we, as we know, that trend for wealth to be concentrated more and more in smaller numbers at the top, that trend is, that is the trend in many of the wealthiest and most powerful nations in the world today. So I don't think we can afford to ignore this factor of class as another way we are divided. So I'm going to tell a personal story that'll maybe illustrate this a little bit. I grew up in a small town in the eastern states, where the divide between rich and poor was not huge at all. Pretty much everybody was in the middle. I was born as the first child, and my parents, I was bought a 4-acre property about a mile outside this small town. It was a corner that they bought from a farmer on the corner of the farm property. And they built a little foxy Cape Cod house. You know what a Cape Cod house looks like? It has two dormers that look like eyes. I always thought, simple house. And my dad had come back from World War II, and he got a job as a technician at a research lab, an RCA research lab in Princeton, New Jersey. And then he went to night school for 8 years to get the first college degree in his generation of the family, while he was supporting a wife and three young children. And I always thought the GI Bill paid for his tuition, but he told me recently, no, it was the RCA actually subsidized him. I don't think that would happen now. And because we were out of town, I didn't have a group of neighborhood kids the way you do in a town. I was mostly happy to explore the woods and the wild fields that extended around my house. But I did have two girls my age that I played with in the early years of grade school. And I didn't perceive them as rich or poor or myself sort of in the middle. I just perceived difference, and I had no explanation for it. My friend Elaine lived across the road in a boxy house, a little smaller than ours, made of cinder blocks, sort of unpainted, you know, these gray cinder blocks. I didn't go inside her house very often. We mostly played outside, but I found it a little unnerving inside. The kitchen always had an old-fashioned oil-burning stove, and it was really hot. And behind the stove was a hook where the belt hung, because the kids were strapped with the belt. Her parents were in some kind of fundamentalist religious sect, and they were really strict. Her father worked at the town's single factory, but he also kept bees. I think that was his hobby. And one day I was there when he was extracting honey in the kitchen. Her mother was canning the honey. And it was really hot, and the honey was sweet and cloying, and it was a little bit nauseating, and it was all just felt strange to me. You know how little kids just, if it's different from your house, it's a little strange. And my other friend, Hope, lived just outside of town, in a large house on what was once a prosperous farm and is now her parents' estate. This is what has happened in where I used to live, is wealthy people who commute to New York bought up all the farms, put in pools and got horses, drove up the taxes. So they had horses, but I never got to ride. This family had assets that were invisible to me, that allowed her father to be a writer and a successful one. He had an entire study full of books, which to me was an awesome thing. And her mother was a collector and dealer in antiquarian garden books. And the old carriage house of this farm was her book house, so it was a whole house full of books, which was awesome to me. They're all about gardens. Her parents were much older than mine, because it was a second marriage after divorce, which was a rare thing in our little town. And the first time I stayed for dinner, the first course was a consommé served in a wide soup bowl, which we didn't have at my house. And it looked like pea. It was yellow. It had little green flakes floating around it, which were probably oregano. And it was a little slightly nauseating and weird, but I managed to eat it. We didn't have soup like that at our house. I tell this story just to remind us all what it's like when you're little and you don't know what makes the world tick. It's just different. The link amongst these three families is we all had vegetable gardens. And in my family and Elaine's family across the street, the father was in charge of the vegetable garden and the mother did all the canning and preserving. But in my friend Hope's house, the mother was in charge of the gardens, you know, the vegetable, the flower, and the herb garden. And I'm sure she had hired help, but I didn't take note at the time. When we all entered grade 4, our school district redistributed the kids who lived outside the town limits. We all got bused to another town, which was more of a white-collar town. And I remember the day when I happened to walk up to my wealthy friend, and she turned away and started talking to the doctor's daughter. And I was just clueless. I felt quite hurt, but I was clueless. And I went home and told my mom, and my mom kind of froze. She couldn't deal with it. There was nothing she could kind of say or do. She felt, I could tell she was helpless, but I didn't know why. And I have thought, I've been reading a lot of Black American writers lately, and they talk about parents having the talk. When the child first comes home and had a terrible, you know, someone called them a bad word in school, or someone kicked them or beat them up because they were Black, you know, you sit down and you have the talk. But there was no talk about class. It didn't exist, so how can there be a talk about it in those days? It wasn't really until my young adult years that I began to appreciate the class factors that had shaped my environment growing up, my school experiences. And I always wondered, looking back from adulthood, if I had ever turned away from my friend Elaine in the way that my friend Hope turned away from me. We always were friendly. We stayed friendly, but we were never in classes together because I was in the advanced placement classes and she was in the lower echelon. I like to think that I never slighted her, but in a moment of heedlessness, I could have. I could have. So in contrast to this American myth of classlessness, in other times and places in human history, class divisions were visible, understood, and often inescapable. Right? In ancient India, in the time of the Buddha, the caste system had just begun to develop. It wasn't as rigid or as detailed, extremely detailed, as it later became. For those who might not be familiar with the Indian caste system, which still exists today, there are basically four social divisions. The Brahmins, who were the priestly caste, who were believed to have been created out of the god Brahma's mouth. The Kshatriyas, who were nobles, warriors, and administrators, who came from Brahma's chest. The Vaisyas, who were merchants and farmers, came from Brahma's belly. The Sudras were the menial workers and serfs who came from Brahma's legs. Those are the four castes. And then there were the outcasts who had no caste, who were beneath, and came from the soles of Brahma's feet, you know, from the dirt. And the Brahmins were the only caste considered capable of spiritual purification. It's worth noting that light skin was associated with the Brahmins and dark skin with the lower castes. So even though racially they were all the same, although like last week we said there is actually no definitive definition of what race even is. It's what we define, you know, what we call it. But the Buddha insisted that whenever someone was ordained into the Sangha, that they would renounce their caste status and privileges. And they would all be the same and known only as disciples of the son of the Shakyans. Shakya was the Buddha's class name. So these people, the original early Sangha members were known as sons and daughters of the Shakyans. He also maintained that spiritual purification was dependent on one's conduct, not one's birth into a caste. So that meant that anyone of any, regardless of what caste they were born into, had the capacity for spiritual practice and awakening, which is a pretty radical thing to declare, right, in those times. Despite all that, the caste system has remained in force to this day. And it's interesting to note that though Buddhism died out in India, when Islam came in and conquered, the Islamic peoples came in and conquered the population in the 13th century. In modern days, there's been a Buddhist revival among the Dalit, which is the present day term for the untouchable caste. The great Dalit leader and human rights activist B.R. Ambedkar rejected the Hindu caste system. He studied abroad in the West, and he specifically made a study of world religions to see which one would serve his people best, and decided it would be Buddhism. So he that Buddhism would be the most supportive of human dignity and equality. So hundreds of thousands of his followers converted, and to this day, there's a very active Buddhist community among the Dalit. And Alan Senake, who used to be the president or director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, is very active. He has strong connections with that community and works with them. It's really interesting. But what's also interesting is that although Ambedkar embraced Buddhism, he rejected the doctrine of karma linked to reincarnation because it had so often been used to justify the oppression of the Dalit. Their suffering in this life must have been due to their misdeeds in former lives. So he completely rejected the doctrine of reincarnation, but took the Eightfold Path and all the practices that the Buddha taught. Some Western Buddhists have begun to articulate a kind of more complex view of karma that takes into consideration the causes and effects of our collective human behaviors, rather than pinning everything down to individual karma, you know, and past deeds and misdeeds, and incorporates this larger, more complex view, incorporates concepts of justice and human rights. And part of this complexity is the way that differences intersect. We talked about that last week, that the buzzword intersectionality, right? We need to bring awareness to the ways that class or poverty and wealth intersect with gender or race or age or physical and mental health and ability. All those intersections with class or wealth and poverty distribution make a difference. So if you combine one or more of those other factors with poverty, it's even harder to climb out of poverty, or even easier to slip out of the middle class back into poverty if you combine gender, race, age, physical, mental health, or ability issues. If you want to read a really excellent account of how this works for Black Americans, Ta-Nehisi Coates, a journalist, American journalist, wrote a book called We Were 8 Years in Power, an American Tragedy. And he was writing over the 8 years of the Obama administration. It's a real eye-opening book. And if you want to know how this works for First Nations peoples in the U.S. and Canada, you can read Thomas King's The Inconvenient Indian. Both I would really recommend. These points of intersection are places where oppression and suffering are amplified, but they're also points of connection where understanding and alliance can grow. In my earlier talks, I referenced a key Zen text, a poem from the 8th century in 8th century China called Merging of Difference and Unity, about the Buddhist teachings of the Two Truths. Right, some of you are familiar with this. In the poem, there's the truth of difference, or particularity, or relativity, and that's represented by light, because in the light we can see that each one of us looks different. And the truth of unity, or oneness, and that's represented by darkness. In the dark, everything merges, you can't see the distinctions. And they're both true all the time, simultaneously. So Here are a few lines from the poem. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. So from the perspective of the relative everyday world, we see the differences. We see differences in the language people use, the way they dress, the kind of music they like, right? And we can key them in with different class and race and gender factors. From the perspective of oneness, all those are manifestations of human life and culture. Right? No better, no worse. Here's a few more lines. The four elements return to their natures just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and tastes. So here that the poem is describing the elements, right? The elements that make up this world and our senses. And the way that they're distinct, but they function together as a whole system. The earth, our body. And then just a few more lines. Thus, with each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence. Revered and common, each has its speech. So here again, the poem is telling us that we share common roots in our humanity, in our manifesting as living beings on this earth, expressed in wonderfully diverse ways. Right? So when we shut others out of our heart and mind because of perceived difference, we shut ourselves out. We circumscribe our capacity to feel others' suffering and to respond with care and compassion. I'm going to read you a quote from Angel Kyodo Williams' book called Radical Dharma. Talking race, love, and liberation, I'm going to read a quote by Martin Luther King, who was most certainly a 20th century bodhisattva. He says, "True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It is not haphazard and superficial. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth and say, this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just." So we hear a lot about identity politics these days, either in defense or attacking. It often seems like there's so much attack and defense going on and not enough deep listening. Speaking and listening from the heart. And when someone different from us is speaking from the heart, and they are all around us, it is our practice to listen deeply. I'm going to read you some words from Zenju Earthland Manual, The Way of Tenderness, and she's in our San Francisco Zen Center lineage. Did you meet her ever, Carmen?
Yeah,
I met her just once. She says, "Multiplicity in oneness does not mean that preferences, opinions, likes, dislikes, even hate cease to be present, cease to arise. Everything is here. Challenges arise when we cling to one extreme among multiplicities, unwilling to acknowledge the presence of difference. It isn't always necessary to engage that difference, but giving it an inner bow allows us to experience the whole landscape of oneness. By not acknowledging difference, we unwittingly exaggerate the difference until it screams to be acknowledged." Inclusiveness underlies oneness. Being aware of the multiplicity in oneness requires that we recognize the collective nature of our lives. It is crucial that we see the variety of lived experiences within oneness in order to see who we really are as living beings. So I hope over these past few weeks, you know, and I've said just, you know, talking for half an hour on each of these subjects really kind of does injustice to them because they're huge. They're huge. But as I've also said, not to try is to maintain silence and avoidance. So I hope that in these few weeks and our brief exchanges where we sit in circle and listen to each other briefly, that we've expanded our capacity even a little bit to live fully engaged in this dynamic world of difference and unity. So that we can bring the perspectives of both wisdom and compassion to our interactions in the world. Next week, we're going to go another step into diversity and think about other species, because they bring such wonder to our lives, and because without them, we humans simply are not going to survive. So, one more week. But for now, I'd like us to get into two circles like we've done each week. And I'm just going to ask you to reflect on any early awarenesses in your life of rich and poor, class distinction. You know, when did that come into you? How did that come into your awareness? And another question you can consider is noticing any of those intersections of how wealth and poverty intersect with or have intersected with gender, race, age, physical, mental health or ability. Any observations that you... I mean, you weren't thinking in those terms. Certainly I wasn't thinking in those terms when I was growing up, but with hindsight we can see. Yeah, so your any early experiences you want to... or awareness that you want to bring forward, and also with hindsight, any observations that you... might want to offer. Okay, so I'm going to turn this off.